am Will McHenry, the program associate at PONARS Eurasia, and with us today is Harris Malonis, an associate professor of political science at George Washington University. Harris, thank you so much for joining me for this PONARS podcast. What are de facto states? What challenges do they pose to the international system?
Yeah, so de facto states are a little hard to define because they overlap with some other categories in the minds of many people. So there are about 193 odd states in the world, but the sovereignty in some of these states is contested. It's not only contested by de facto states, which we're going to define in a minute, but they're also challenged by sometimes anti-regime guerrillas or stateless nationalist movements that are different from de facto states in the sense that de facto states control territory. They actually have a lot of sovereignty on the ground, unlike most stateless nationalist movements, which are aspiring to statehood. At the same time, de facto states are not anti-regime guerrillas because they seek self-determination rather than just change the regime at the capital of a country. So they're different from other challenges. They also violate the principle of territorial integrity, of course, and that's how most international relations scholars get interested in de facto states. It's because they obviously are entities who want to modify the borders of the contemporary state system. So in that sense, the international system is often unsettled by such cases that emerge every now and then. And of course, these can become source of interstate war and definitely involve intrastate war, right? Civil wars, because very rarely these de facto states are the product of peaceful situations.
Are all de facto states alike?
Well, well, they're alike in terms of structural, characteristics that help us define them and code them, but of course, they're not alike when it comes to real world, on the ground kind of facts. We could say there is a range of de facto statehood, and definitely some de facto states have more agency than others. Just to fix ideas, I'll give some examples. We can say that Turkey practically built a de facto state in the north part of the island of Cyprus following the 1974 invasion, but it hasn't always controlled fully the internal dynamics in that part. While we can say the same, for example, about the recent relationship between Russia and Abkhazia and South Ossetia, it seems that Russia has a much stronger hold and say. Again, these are all relative notions. Of course, there is no absolute control by an external patron of a de facto state. Most de facto states, we should say, exist because they have some strong external backing. Not all of them, but the majority, we could point to an external patron being involved at either the beginning, in the emergent stage, or later on. And that's another important characteristic feature of de facto states. So in that sense, we could say that there is important variation in terms of the agency they have and in terms of the relationship they have with their external patron. Similarly, we can draw a distinction, another distinction based on whether the external patron is a kin state or a purported kin state or not, whether the external patron is contiguous or not, and so on and so forth. We could parse this out in multiple ways, and that could create different categories of de facto states if we would like to think about them like that. Yeah.
Did you find any interesting patterns while writing your policy memos on de facto states?
Yeah. When I started looking more closely to the at the cases, there is some important work on this topic, many people, Kosto, Berg, Florea, Coggins, a lot of scholars have dealt with this problem, and many more I'm not mentioning right now. What I was finding fascinating from my geopolitical perspective was that most de facto states that were that emerged in the Cold War, and I have made some maps to depict that, none of them, not surprisingly from anyone who knows history, but none of them emerged in NATO or within NATO members or within Warsaw Pact members. And the explanation is obvious for people who study these topics, but a bipolar system was, my conclusion was that in a bipolar system where the two poles, the hegemons of each pole, are really trying to keep their things in order and run a tight show, won't let any of these things, you know, survive. And we see that de facto states only emerge in mainly in Africa, basically sub-Saharan Africa, and some in East Asia. But we don't see any de facto states at all in the two poles, within the two poles. Similarly, another interesting pattern, if we look at the whole period, we see no de facto states in the Americas. North and South America have no de facto states based on the criteria we're using to code de facto states. And then, of course, in the post-Cold War, we see that there are de facto states suddenly in all of Eastern Europe and of course, the former Soviet Union. And that's not surprising once you go into the geopolitics of this, obviously, and you've started with this hypothesis of Cold War versus post-Cold War. Yes, the losing side of the Cold War is vulnerable after 1990, and there is a large number of de facto states that emerge. Now, many of them disappear, and many of them don't survive, but a few of them linger and still survive to this day. The other last pattern we see is that the Middle East increasingly it's featured in these maps as an area where de facto states become more prominent. So again, it seems that from a geopolitical perspective, the conclusion I'm drawing is that the patterns would be more easily explained if we look at the international system at its point in time, and then usually we would find such entities emerging in the areas in the periphery of the system or in the vulnerable sides of the system. Usually, of course, as a result of rivalry and great politics, great power politics competition.
Yeah, to follow up on that, do you draw any conclusions for the future of de facto states?
Yeah, well, as I said, a lot will depend on the structure of the international system. And of course, the structure of the international system is not independent of the preferences of the actors of the international system. So depending on, for example, the future behavior and preferences of the United States of America and Russia, we may see more or less room for such entities to emerge. And what I'm implying by that is the US and Russia have been both in favor of territorial integrity in some cases, and they've backed self-determination cases, self-determination movements in other cases. So easily, if somebody thinks about the role the US played in Kosovo, and then, you know, at the same time, we think about the role that Russia played in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, or even the role that Russia played in Crimea, which is a different role than the one in South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And I do go into the memo, into the calculus of a great power like Russia, deciding whether to annex a territory or whether to leave it as a de facto state, which I think is a complicated equation, especially for a contiguous external patron. So based on those behaviors, we can't be very optimistic that, you know, things will be quiet, because both the US and Russia have been playing this game. But what I'm ending my policy memo with is pondering And wondering what would China do in the future as a future hegemonic or rising power. Would it remain a champion of territorial integrity as it pretends to be, or at least claims to be, let's say today, with its emphasis on borders as they are and so on and so forth. And of course, we know why it's doing that, because of its own internal problems with some restive minorities. Or would China's assertiveness coming at, ascendance, let's say, will its ascendance encourage China to assume the role of an external patron, as the US has done in the past, or and Russia has done in the past, or the Soviet Union, and play that game as it's rising in the international system, in order to destabilize rival states or for whatever purposes. So a lot, I think, about the future of this phenomenon will depend on the preference structure of these hegemonic states and the relationship between those states that will then, of course, form what we call the international system at the time, because these relationships and these preferences are obviously interrelated, and they inform each other. So we'll see. So the future could be a future of a new bipolar system, with China being a new pole, or it could be a decentralized system of spheres of influence, where different big powers or major powers are responsible for different parts of the world. And that would mean that the standards for these issues, the situation for de facto states, will be different in each of these regions, right? So yeah, when I talk about the international system, it doesn't mean that there will be one standard for the whole world as, you know, we know it. It could, the future could hold or could mean a system of decentralized kind of subsystems or regional systems where different standards are enforced. So we need to be vigilant and write another memo when the time comes.
Harris, fascinating. Thank you so much for joining me for this Ponars podcast.
Thank you for having me, and good luck with